You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. I'm speaking with Jeremy Lassen. He's the publisher of Nightshade Books. They've just released Eclipse 2. Thank you for joining me, Jeremy.
Great talking with you, Rick.
Jeremy, tell me about the genesis of this project, the Eclipse series itself.
Well, the Eclipse series came about from our relationship with the editor, Jonathan Strand. He edited our Year's Best series, Year's Best Fantasy and Science Fiction. He's been an anthologist for quite some time. And he pitched the idea to us of an original non-theme anthology. He pointed out that pretty much the last original non-theme anthology in the field had been Patrick Nielsen Hayden's Starlight trilogy or Starlight anthology, and there wasn't any ongoing, you know, original fiction venues anymore that were non-themed in the anthology market. And you know, I'm a big fan of the old, you know, Terry Carr, Damon Knight, those old original anthologies that were kind of the core of a lot of, you know, science fiction and development of the science fiction short form. And, you know, Jonathan and I kind of share that passion, and I kind of jumped at the opportunity to help continue that tradition.
Well, tell me a little bit maybe about some of your experiences with Damon Knight's Orbit. Boy, I remember getting those a bazillion years ago, and the Terry Carr universe anthologies as well. They actually went on. I mean, Damon Knight, I think they were doing like two of them a year at some point, and they were went on for a number of years.
Yeah, they absolutely did. They had, I think, upwards of, like, you know, some of the series, Orbit, I think, went to 18, 20 odd, you know, volumes, and there was enough of them that when I started reading short fiction habitually in the early 80s, pawing through used bookstores, you know, I would see stacks and stacks of them. And they were like buried treasure for me, because I didn't, you know, as a younger reader, I didn't have a lot of connection to the community or know that there was even a community out there. I was just looking for, you know, stuff that I enjoyed that was like other stuff that I enjoyed. And, you know, I didn't know editors' names. I didn't know who Damon Knight was at the time or Terry Carr. But they became names that I associated with this great experience, because they were just a cornucopia of absolutely diverse short fiction that was kind of at the cutting edge of what science fiction could do. And, you know, I just found those anthologies to be kind of the cornerstone of my genre experience. And so, you know, those are the places that I first discovered writers who I didn't know, or who I didn't know that I knew. But after those series, that's when I began looking for names like, you know, Theodore Sturgeon or Harlan Ellison, or, you know, any of the John Barleys, any of the great, you know, kind of short fiction writers from the, you know, 70s and, you know, 60s and 70s and 80s. I found them there. And that, you know, that's what led me, you know, to go further down the tree to things like Dangerous Visions, or, you know, they were the seeds.
Now, starting this series yourself with Eclipse 1, you say it's non-themed, but could you tell me maybe about some of the trends you found that happened for Eclipse 1 and maybe some of the differences from Eclipse 2?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it started, well, we tweaked the evolution of it purposefully after Eclipse 1 came out. You know, it was an anthology of both science fiction and fantasy, and just through the nature of who turned in their stories for Volume 1, it ended up being an anthology that skewed more towards the contemporary fantastic. You know, not quite urban fantasy, you know, elves and, you know, downtown kind of a thing, but, you know, more the Jeffrey Fords or the Kelly Links. And that anthology skewed heavily towards that, just from the nature of we had really tight deadlines, and those are the stories that got turned in, and those are the stories that Jonathan selected. But we wanted to make sure that the anthology didn't get categorized, because that was something that was recognized very quickly through the reviews of Eclipse One. You know, they were like, yeah, a lot of good stories here, and most of it's fantasy. And we just didn't want the Eclipse brand to be pigeonholed quite that easily, and so we suggested that maybe Jonathan should, actively have more of a, big widescreen, not necessarily space opera, but, a heavier lean towards science fiction for Volume 2. And so, and he did that in spades, and it's got some just phenomenal stories in here that are, some of which are part of, science fiction authors' ongoing, science fiction series, their ongoing universes. And it was just a desire to not have the series pigeonholed, I guess, that had us focus more on, outside in space kinds of things. Although there's plenty of near future science, more on the science fiction rather than fantasy side, I should say.
Well, thumbing through it, I see we start off with a new Virga story by Carl Schrader. Tell us a little bit about getting somebody who's got like a series of novels that are doing quite well to contribute an original short story to this series. Was this something you commissioned or said? He said, "Oh, I've got this laying around."
Well, I think it was something that he wrote for Jonathan after Jonathan queried him.
Oh,
and
really?
Said, "Hey, do you have anything?" And I suspect. It's been my experience with authors who have novel series that they have a lot of stories to tell, and they work out in detail a lot of the characters and timelines and places and things that are going on, and there's a lot of cul-de-sacs that don't fit into their novels, and I suspect that either this was, something that was already half-formed or, something that he just, took a kernel and ran with it. But it was Jonathan approaching him. I'm not quite sure if it was already a completed piece that had been bouncing around, but Jonathan did actively go after that, because I know Jonathan's a big fan, big fan of that series. I am too. I've been watching Carl's work for a long time now, and it's been really exciting to see, Carl develop as a writer over the years, and that kind of old school development of a writer. I mean, I give big props to his publisher for sticking with him over two series, a standalone novel, and really committed to building up, letting Carl Schroeder find his wings, because he's one of my favorites.
Another science fiction writer with a couple of popular series, Al Reynolds, makes an appearance here. Now, is his story part of his series?
No, it's not, but he's got a couple of different series, mm-hmm. but... It's not part of the Revelation Space cycle,
mm-hmm.
but Al's another writer who seems to write way more short fiction than you would think possible, given that he pretty much writes a novel a year, because he's had two massive collections come out in the last couple of years, one from Nightshade, and it's kind of funny because we commissioned that collection, or we approached him for that collection like 6 or 7 years ago, and he kept on saying, no, I don't have enough fiction. And then it kind of like exploded, and then he had like two collections that came out kind of back to back. So I think, Al's another example of a writer who has a strong vision of the kind of worlds he's writing in and has a lot of cul-de-sacs.
I'm also really pleased to see a Ted Chiang story here. And could you talk a little bit about that story? Because Ted Chiang isn't the guy we think of as a science fiction necessarily writer. He's more in just, I guess, kind of an experimental mode. And he takes that, but this also has a really interesting science fiction twist to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. The Ted Chiang story is... like one of the kind of joys of being able to do this anthology. Ted's story kind of fell in at the last moment, and I don't know if it was a matter of Ted was writing for the themes that Jonathan had like kind of outlined in his solicitation letter. But yeah, it does sort of stand out. It's not really, like you say, the kind of story you'd expect to necessarily see from Ted, but I think that's kind of now that's his mark of a Ted Chiang story is its unexpectedness. or its lack of kowtowing to conventions, and even to the point of not falling into an easy category within his own work doesn't fall into simple, easy categories. And that was one that came in. We had one story that fell out of the book at the last minute due to some rights issues, and Ted kind of called up Jonathan and said, "Hey, do you still need this story?" And I mean, that speaks volumes to Jonathan's position in the field, where one of the great short fiction writers, who's not terribly prolific, called him up and said, "Hey, do you still have room for my story?" And that was just an absolute joy when Jonathan called me up and said, "Hey, do we have a little bit extra word count? Because we might have a Ted Chiang story." And so I fell all over myself saying, "Whatever word count you need, man, let's get Ted in there."
Now, we also have Paul Cornell, who just won a Hugo for Doctor Who. I think that's really interesting to find a writer migrating from science fiction TV, although he has published novels, to short story collections.
Yeah. No, I mean, Paul's that perfect example of a writer who, he's not on the bestseller list, or at least not in the U.S. He's not terribly well-known in the U.S., but he's one of the mid-list guys that forms the backbone of the genre. He's been writing, four or five novels right now, maybe even six, I think. He's been writing for a while, and his short fiction is always really compelling. I mean, he's one of those names that he doesn't turn up all the time on the front of the covers, or on the star-studded "Here's Our Bestsellers" kind of a thing. But I don't know. That's another one of the joys of a non-theme anthology that we have the proper expectations for in the marketplace. I mean, I understand what the size of the market is and how many copies I'm going to sell, so we can get the Paul Cornells. We can get the people in here who just write great fiction and sell the package as a whole. It's just really great to be able to do that.
Now I was really pleased to see Peter Beagle and Terry Dowling in there. Now, they're both writing fantasy for this, or more on the fantasy side for this.
Yeah. Jonathan seems to have a really great relationship with Peter. Peter was in Volume 1 and Volume 2. And I talked briefly with him about it. I was like, "Well, I'm not going to second guess you here on this, but can you explain to me we have relatively few slots for original fiction in this anthology, like going back to the same writer. Is that what we want to do from one volume to the next? Do we want to keep repeating these writers?" And he was like, "Well, that is in the mold of the Orbit anthologies that we're basing this on. That was a common practice." And when you have one of the best short fiction writers of his generation writing short fiction and being prolific, it's hard to say no to that. And, Peter Beagle definitely falls into that category. Go on.
Oh, well, one thing I wanted to mention was I really love the cover of this book. It's really interesting because it harkens back. It reminds me, I look at that and I think, it reminds me of 2001, A Space Odyssey. It has that kind of echo of, "Let Me In, Dave," that kind of pod. But also it has a really, the artist who is?
Donato is his shorthand, how he's referred to, but that's his first name, Donato. Donato Giannacola.
He's really captured, I think, a really nice kind of 70s vibe. It's perfectly appropriate for the 21st century, but there's a certain kind of 70s vibe in the way he's softened the lines of some of this of this spaceship. And I'm wondering how much input you had and the art director had, Michael Fusco. Is that Fusco Brothers? Fusco?
No, Fusco. he's one of our designers out of Wisconsin there. He's great. He did the original series design on this and really kind of like helped us establish a visual identity for it. Because definitely the typography and, the kind of design is kind of a mix of the kind of bigger, balloonier block letters that you more traditionally associate with the 70s, but it's got kind of like, kind of an askew, they're at angles across the cover. And that was all, Fusco's design. But the artwork, it's actually kind of funny. I don't have a really big art budget, but I've always wanted this series to be a prestige series. And so for the first cover, Michael Whalen had an unpublished piece that he let us use.
Mm-hmm.
And for this one, Donato is one of the, you know, kind of standout giants in the field right now. I mean, his work is instantly identifiable and, you know, he constantly wins Spectrum Awards. And in fact, this piece was the cover for the Spectrum anthology, Spectrum 12, I believe it was, so for the previous year. And it had so been previously used, but it hadn't been used in this framing. And I was talking to him at Comic-Con, and he was talking about how he loves to do the kind of, like, shiny metal. He doesn't get to do a lot of science fiction. He does more fantasy covers, is usually what he's commissioned for.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he loves to do the kind of, like, the shiny metal, as he referred to it as. And so, like, just the kind of light as it plays off the helmet of the astronauts or of the, you know, the metal space pod. You know, he's got, in the original, it's even more clear. He's just got a really incredible play of light. And I think that kind of focus on light and lighting combined with this, you know, it has almost the sense of weightlessness from this cover was what drew it to me. Like, I really felt that captured a sense of wonder. It, you know, kind of associating those two, like, wow, what would it be like to be weightless? And this painting of this astronaut above a horizon, which is theoretically Earth, but, you know, a blue horizon in space, kind of just captured that sense. And I thought, well, that's perfect. And so he was very, very generous in that, you know, like I said, I have a very small art budget, but he was like, you know what, I'll, you know, you can do this, you can use this piece, an existing piece. And I was really pleased. And it fit perfectly in the series design, because that's really what I was going for, is, you know, that sense of wonder that I got when I was pawing through those paperbacks of those Damon Knight and Terry Carr anthologies. I wanted to, you know, convey that to a new generation. And I was really pleased to be able to work with Donato on this.
Now, one thing about these kind of series, they benefit from longevity. And so I'm wondering if you are prepared to, you know, invest in this for the long haul.
Well, we've already got Volume 3 under contract, and, you know, Jonathan's already reading for that. And barring financial catastrophe, I mean, it's a fixture in our schedule. I mean, we've had the long game in mind when we did this series. You know, we weren't going to make a lot of money or any money out the gate on Volume 1 by itself. But by publishing an anthology long-term over time, it allows us to build up that prestige. It allows, you know, I mean, we didn't get Ted Chiang for Volume 1, but we got him for Volume 2. And, you know, we got a lot of other, you know, really great A-list writers, you know, for both volumes. But I think the longer that Jonathan's out there reading for it, you know, an author may or may not be able to meet a deadline for a specific year, but or for a specific volume, but it's in the back of their mind. And I think having that kind of long-term market and giving Jonathan that long-term stability is key towards, you know, establishing the brand. So I'm firmly committed to it. You know, I mean, this is why I got into publishing, to publish the books that I wanted to read. And, you know, this is definitely one of them. So I've got a long-term commitment to this.
Now, you just mentioned why you got into publishing. I think this is kind of interesting because this is actually, to a certain extent, kind of an evolution for you. You started out publishing, you know, the great, currently unavailable works. I'm thinking of Manly Wade Wellman and William Hope Hodgson. So as you step out more and more into original, you know, and those are more fantasy classics. So you're stepping out more and more into, you know, original science fiction. That's a big stride for you. Does it change, you know, the way you look around when you're looking for people, or are you still looking for more forgotten classics to publish? You know, A. Merritt, maybe? Who knows?
Well, it's interesting because I see it as an extension of publishing more of that thing that really inspired me when I was a young reader. And the Manly Wade Wellmans and the Lord Dunsany's and the William Hope Hodgson's, these are kind of like icons that really grabbed me, you know. And I ended up publishing them. And I was really lucky to be able to be in the place and time where, you know, there was a lot of demand and their work wasn't available in the marketplace, and I kind of seized on that. And so to kind of be able to do that same type of thing for original short fiction, you know, there's not a lot of other original short fiction anthologies out there in the marketplace. I mean, because frankly, it's not a really big market, and if there were 5 or 6 original anthologies every year of original short fiction, non-themed original short fiction, Eclipse would have a rougher go at it because they're, you know, the market can only support so many anthologies, and so it's a matter of recognizing the opportunity. But we've always wanted to publish a wide range of styles. Jason and I joke that, you know, when you ask about are we still looking for weird fiction, well, we are, but our Clark Ashton Smith 5-volume set of his complete fantasies is kind of the caps, is kind of like the culmination of our classic reprint, because of the writers that are still out there that we haven't published, a lot of other publishers have picked up the slack, be it Nespa, be it Hafner Press. There's a lot of, you know, kind of classic science fiction writers out there who are being being collected up. So the reprint of weird fiction and of classic, you know, kind of classic fiction market, I think we've sort of peaked with our Clark Ashton Smith, but there's still opportunities. You know, this Eclipse series is one of them. I don't have the signed contract yet, but I'll actually tell you about one of my exciting books we've got coming for next year. We're going to do an original collection of uncollected work with Barry Malzberg, who I think is absolutely stunning and spectacular. And, you know, not a lot of people are familiar with his work, but he was one of the, you know, mainstay workhorses of the 50s and 60s and 70s in the, you know, in the short fiction markets and, in the shorter novels of the day. And I'm really excited to be able to, you know, publish a collection of his fiction. And so I think projects like that are my continuation of, you know, of our Manly Wade Wellman and Hodgson series.
Publish
those guys that really influenced me. And, you know, whatever the nature of the project is, you know, being able to do those is such a joy.
I've been speaking with Jeremy Lassen. The newest book from Nightshade Books is Eclipse 2. Thank you for joining me, Jeremy.
My pleasure. Great talking with you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.